You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, pregnancies are down around the country for girls under 17, especially for girls in their early teen years. Our guest tells us about the changes she's seen in the greater Milwaukee area. First, just about a year ago, the DNR awarded a permit to the company Meteor Timber to build a sand processing plant in Monroe County. But late last week, an administrative law judge rescinded that permit, saying that the DNR had failed at several steps in the process to ensure that all requirements would be met and that they had sufficiently studied the environmental impacts. WPR reporter Rich Kramer has been following the story. He joins us from our Eau Claire studios. Rich, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, remind us about this project, Meteor Timber, and what would be a new frac sand processing plant in Monroe County.
Well, this project has been in the works for like 2 years, 2015, early 2016 was when we first started hearing rumblings in this region of, you know, western Wisconsin. But like you mentioned in the lead-in, the permit was issued in May of last year. Another kind of an addendum, an amended permit was issued in August of last year. But in a nutshell, this would be a $75 million project that would include a mine and a processing facility and rail loading facility that would be about 14 miles away from the mine. But this is all in near Warrens, Wisconsin, in Jackson County.
And a lot of the controversy over this plan and then the legal proceedings centers around wetlands that would be filled in, and then that would be created under the plan to kind of make up for that.
Absolutely. So the biggest the controversy of this project was that the plan to build the rail loading facility would fill in 16 acres of what has been described by the DNR as high-quality wetlands, including 13 acres of very rare white pine red maple swamp. And so this project, to go forward, what you do is you have to apply for a permit from the DNR, and you have to show how you're going to mitigate that, how you're going to either buy credits from a wetland mitigation bank or build your own wetlands. So the company planned on, in the permit, it said it was going to preserve 296 acres of wetlands on that property, and it also pledged to preserve 183 acres of wetlands nearby, and then convert a 33-acre cranberry bed into hardwood swamp, like what they are proposing to fill in. But the judge, in a nutshell, basically said that the permits shouldn't have been issued because the DNR didn't have the information that it should have had, and also it said that the mitigation plan didn't fulfill state law, so it didn't have enough information, and there were some questions that were left unanswered.
We'll dig into that DNR process in a moment, but first, Rich, who challenged this permit? Who took this to court and ultimately got this rescinded?
Well, originally it was two environmental groups. Clean Wisconsin is the one that stayed with the challenge throughout the process, and Midwest Environmental Advocates also kind of signed on to this, but the challenge was brought on behalf of a group of citizens from the Ho-Chunk Nation. So they challenged the permit. They basically told the company and the DNR that they were going to challenge this even before the permit was issued, because they felt that the process, you know, had been rushed, basically. And so in June of last year is when they officially challenged it. And the process is called a contested case hearing, where you challenge the permit that was issued before an administrative law judge.
Talking to Rich Kramer, WPR reporter in Eau Claire, about a proposed frac sand facility in western Wisconsin. A permit from the DNR rescinded last week by a judge. Rich, you did some digging into the DNR process here, filed open records requests. What did you find about how they handled this approval?
Well, just based on the emails that I got through this open records request, and I basically asked for all the emails related to Meteor Timber, this project, and I got a lot of communications between the people that approve these projects. So we're talking about the wetlands and waterway staff at the DNR down in Madison. They've got them around the state. It was pretty obvious looking through these emails that the staff were being asked to look at these incredibly complex documents, as much as 1,000 pages. They were being asked to review them and comment on them and come up with questions based on what they had read. And in within like a business day or over the weekend. And the staff obviously were frustrated by that. And then I spoke with Pat Truckle, who was a DNR wetland ecologist who worked on this permit. And I also spoke with some people that didn't want to be on the record, but who also worked on the permit. And they said that there was absolutely pressure. They were told by administration in the DNR that they were going to approve this project no matter what. So there was a lot of pressure, it seemed like.
Is there any indication, either from those comments or from the court ruling, that there was intentional wrongdoing on the part of DNR leadership?
Well, that's that's hard to prove. All I know is that they were told by DNR administration at the time. It was Kathy Stepp, and also it was Kurt Thiede, who was the deputy administrator. I kept hearing things from these people that, well, eighth floor, that's the floor where the administration was, you know, will only let us have four monitoring wells when they might have more. They were kind of told what questions to ask and what sort of things were off limits. So I didn't really get into motive or intent with this, but just based on the documents and information that I got from the interviews, it was obvious that there was some pressure from the top.
Now, we had this ruling on Friday rescinding this permit. What have we heard since then? Let's start with from the company itself, Meteor Timber.
So the company is represented by John Bailing of Weld Riley Law Firm in Eau Claire. They're basically one of the top frac sand mining law firms that assist these companies in getting permits. So the statement from Meteor Timber through John Bailing basically said that they respected the judge's decision. They understand that this process is lengthy, but they disagreed with it. And the key line that I saw was, we will continue to work toward ensuring that this project can benefit the local communities that will be impacted. And that's attributed to Chris Mathis, who was an employee at Meteor Timber and is really the face of the company in Wisconsin. There's also a lobbying group called the Natural Resources Defense Council that kind of was created and was born during the push to repeal the non-metallic mining moratorium that the state had. And also they've been pushing hard in the legislature with this project for Meteor Timber, and they probably helped get the bills that were introduced as amendments that would have exempted the company from wetland regulations.
Right, there are efforts in the legislature to kind of to make this process moot by changing the law on behalf in a way that would have benefited Meteor Timber.
Yeah, so while this was held up in court, you know, the company had, the company told me that Chris Mathis said that they had been at this for 2 years. They felt like they had gone above and beyond in satisfying regulators and the local communities. So they felt that it was time to go to the legislature. So what they did was they got a lawmaker, a state representative who's from southeastern Wisconsin, introduced twice an amendment to mostly unrelated bills that would have basically kind of bypassed the court, and it would have exempted Meteor Timber from wetland regulations entirely. But both times those amendments died along with the bills that they were attached to. And one state senator, Republican state Senator Rob Coles of Green Bay, he was especially upset about that, and he even called the move outrageous and basically said, where would it end if we went along with this?
And how about on the plaintiff side? What do we hear in their reactions to this court ruling?
So Clean Wisconsin, you know, they're obviously pleased with this. They felt like they were trying to protect the integrity of the of the wetland permitting process. They also say that they're going to stick with it. You know, if Meteor Timber appeals this, which they can, the staff attorney Evan Feinauer told me that they'll defend this, the environment and the process that is enshrined in state law and DNR regulations, as long as they need to.
Here is some sound of Evan Feinauer from Clean Wisconsin.
It's important that the department have all the information that's necessary to identify the environmental impacts, the prospect for doing mitigation, kind of all just the relevant questions that you should ask. And these aren't, you know, the questions that we think they should be asking. These are the questions that are contained in the regulations and in the department's own guidance. And it's just important from a scientific perspective to have all that information in hand when you make these important decisions.
And that's the plaintiff and the company. And how about the DNR? Have they reacted to this ruling?
DNR, all they said, a statement from Jim Dick, who is the communications director, basically said they were reviewing the judge's decision. Since then, I haven't heard anything. I don't know what the next step is for the DNR. What I learned from Clean Wisconsin is that either the DNR or Meteor Timber can appeal this. So we'll see. It looks like the company, you know, while they haven't said that they will appeal it, it looks like they're going to proceed and try to make this thing happen. And they've spent a lot of money, and they've been involved with trying to get the approval for this project for some time. So it'll be interesting to see what their next step is.
Rich, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thank you, Rob.
That's WPR reporter Rich Kramer joining us from our Eau Claire studios to discuss Meteor Timber's permit to build a sand processing plant. The permit was rescinded by an administrative law judge late last week. First, more than 8,000 babies were born to girls aged 10 to 14 in the United States in the year 2000. In 2016, the number of those births dropped a lot, down to 2,000. While the state of Wisconsin doesn't track pregnancies for girls younger than 15, teen pregnancy rates have declined here in the state. Nicole Agresano is the Vice President of Community Impact for United Way Greater Milwaukee and Waukesha County. Nicole, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I know we don't always have specific numbers for every age group, but in general, what kind of trends are you seeing in Milwaukee when it comes to teens having babies?
We are seeing tremendously positive trends in Milwaukee. In fact, since the inception, or since we really started tracking this data as an initiative at United Way of Greater Milwaukee and Waukesha County, the rate in general for 15 to 17-year-olds has gone from 52 per thousand to 18 per thousand, which is over a 64% reduction, which is just extraordinary.
Now, what caught us in these national numbers were these girls very young giving birth, age 10 to 14. Well, we don't have numbers, as I understand it, from the Milwaukee area. Anecdotally, what are you seeing there?
Well, anecdotally, the rate is going down across age groups. To your point, we don't get data for young people under the age of 14, although we have gotten some anecdotal information from the school system and other youth providing agencies over the years. And we know that those numbers are very small. But any number, any girl becoming pregnant at that young of an age is something we need to really pay attention to, and make sure that even though the data isn't necessarily consistently tracked, that if we hear about it in the community, we're ready to respond accordingly.
Right. That's one of those numbers you want to be zero. Can you talk about the impact of early childbirth, even as old as those older teenagers are talking about? What are some of the problems that come along with that?
So, you know, it's sometimes difficult to talk about this because I want to acknowledge that there are teen parents out there who have done an extraordinary job raising their children. And so we try very hard not to vilify or use shaming language. But the reality is that it's not an ideal outcome. And when babies are born to teens, or even to young adults in their late teens or early 20s who aren't either emotionally, financially, or otherwise prepared to be parents, a lot of outcomes shift to the negative. For example, children born to teen parents are less likely to graduate from high school on time. Boys born to teen parents are more likely to have some involvement in the juvenile justice system. Again, that's not across the board, but the data indicates that there are some trends that we need to be concerned about. And that in the best of circumstances, adults in a loving relationship have babies on purpose when, if they're not totally able to, or we would never have kids, they're at least more able to than you might be at 15 or 16.
What kind of efforts do you work on there at the United Way, first of all, to help prevent teen pregnancy in the area?
So we have a really a broad and vast network of community partners that have been working on this with us for over a decade. We have an incredible media campaign. We have an exceptional partner in Milwaukee Public Schools that has been doing evidence-based human growth and development for years. We work what I would argue are some of the best community-based organizations in the country who are doing evidence-based curriculum with middle school students and high school age kids. We have an all-hands-on-deck effort. Members of the business community, of the foundations community, have contributed funding to make sure that this is a sustainable multi-year effort. And what you're seeing is what happens when we use a collective impact model, when multiple and diverse groups come together and focus together collectively on one outcome. And for us, that outcome has always been reducing births to 15 to 17-year-olds. And you've seen the results, as I mentioned in the data earlier, an extraordinary downtick in those numbers.
So it's not like there's one magic thing. If we do this one thing, it's going to work. It's a wider effort than that.
That's exactly right. I think sometimes we like to paint age groups or generations with this broad brush that, you know, this is the one thing that'll matter. And what we know is that, you know, sometimes folks ask me, what do I think the most important thing is? I think the most important thing is that young people are given evidence-based, sound information so they can make informed decisions. But I think that, coupled with a media campaign, coupled with, and I neglected to mention this earlier, strategies to help parents be their children's primary health educators, all those things working together is why you've seen our community's rate go down at a rate faster than the national levels.
Nicole Agresano is with us from the United Way of Greater Milwaukee and Waukesha County, talking about steep declines in the number of teens giving birth there and efforts on along those lines. And Nicole, I want to talk about you mentioned there are still people who do have kids in their teens. What kind of support is out there to help their kids and to help them do things like graduate from high school?
That's a great question. We have a number of community programs that are very supportive of pregnant and parenting teens, and that includes some very specific strategies embedded at Milwaukee Public Schools where, in some cases, there are opportunities for daycare. In other cases, there's case management and wraparound services because the worst thing that can happen for the young parents, girl or boy, is that they leave school, right? So we want to do whatever we can to make sure that their educational attainment, if possible, is not interrupted. And then there's a number, you know, Milwaukee is replete with wonderful community-based organizations that impact families at every stage of life, prenatal all the way through end-of-life care and everything in between. And so whether the needs are economic or social or health-related, there's an agency partner that likely can help in those areas.
And looking at this drastic decline again, do you have maybe a fear that maybe this is just we've been lucky for a while and things could turn around at the drop of a hat?
You know, I'm a fairly optimistic person, but I do. When we have our annual review of the data, there's a moment of panic every year that what we're doing, what if it's not working anymore? What if we miss something? So we are never, ever complacent or comfortable with this initiative. We understand that, particularly in an issue like teen pregnancy, there are new teens every day, right? That when we started this initiative 12 years ago, you know, we have 2 and 3-year-olds that are now 16 or 17-year-olds, I think I did that math wrong, but you got my point, that we need to make sure that these messages stay fresh and relevant to a whole new generation of young people. So while I am very confident that we have the right partners in place, we are really committed to not becoming complacent and not congratulating ourselves too soon.
You mentioned kind of this target area of 15 to 17, but does that mean education efforts start at age 15, or is there, age-appropriate stuff that starts substantially earlier than that?
That's exactly right. We have curriculum materials, particularly in Milwaukee Public Schools, who has been an exceptional partner, where human growth development starts as early as 5-year-old kindergarten. And I want to be clear, the human growth and development that you're getting in 5-year-old kindergarten doesn't have a lot to do with sex. What it has to do with is your body parts and safety and health. And when you build a foundation, when you help a young person understand what it means to have control over their own bodies, who is and isn't allowed to touch them, how to make make healthy and safe choices, you're laying a foundation where when they're tweens and teens and then adults, they're going to make better decisions for themselves because they're going to have the right information that they need to make informed decisions. So the earlier, the better. One of the things we do at United Way is we provide a toolkit for parents. It's both in English and Spanish because we know that even in the best, I mean, I'm a trained educator. I went to graduate school and studied, even studied sex ed specifically in graduate school. And I sometimes have a hard time answering my 11-year-old's questions. So we know even when you're trained and prepared, that can be hard. So how can we provide more opportunities and more information for parents to feel that they're empowered to have these talks, that they can use their time in the carpool or at dinner to talk about important things that's going to really, again, strengthen their young person's foundation so that they make healthier choices.
And do you feel like you're isolated in some ways in Milwaukee, you're working on the local problem, or do you feel a connection with other communities around the state and the country where you're sharing what works and what doesn't work?
We are really good sharers, I think. One of the things that I'm really proud of over the past few years is the number of times that representatives and teams from other communities have come here to learn, as one of them put, what our secret sauce is. I don't think it's a recipe that's instantly replicable across communities. A lot of the reason we're successful is because of some really special partners here in Milwaukee. I've mentioned a couple of them today, the school system, our community-based organizations, Serve Marketing. But there are lessons we've learned, and I think some mistakes we've made that can really help other communities address this issue and others like it in a really strong way.
Nicole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Nicole Agresano, Vice President of Community Impact for United Way of Greater Milwaukee and Waukesha County, talking about substantial declines in teen pregnancy and childbirth around the country and in particular in the Milwaukee area. First, President Trump announced today that he will pull the United States out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, better known as the Iran nuclear deal.
I will sign a presidential memorandum to begin reinstating U.S. nuclear sanctions on the Iranian regime. We will be instituting the highest level of economic sanction. Any nation that helps Iran in its quest for nuclear weapons could also be strongly sanctioned by the United States. America will not be held hostage to nuclear blackmail.
The president signed that memorandum this afternoon, calling the original 2015 agreement one-sided and, quote, defective at its core, end quote. The decision to pull the U.S. out of the multinational agreement could have far-reaching implications, including with our allies that helped negotiate the deal, and it could color future diplomatic talks with Iran. Our next guest is here to help us understand what happened with the Iran deal today and its place in our history of nuclear anxiety since the end of the Cold War. Stephen Simbala is a distinguished professor of political science at Penn State Brandywine. He's written a number of books on nuclear weapons and diplomacy, including Nuclear Weapons in the Information Age. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello.
Well, what are your thoughts on this decision, this announcement from the president earlier today?
Well, I think it's disappointing. JCPOA was, I think, an important diplomatic accomplishment. It gave us not only an ongoing access to what Iran is doing with respect to its nuclear activities, but it also was endorsed by the entire permanent members of the UN Security Council, plus Germany and the European Union. So we've stepped back from solidarity with our allies on this issue. The British, the French, the Germans have already expressed their dismay. We've also got some people scratching their heads wondering if we can be trusted to keep our word in international agreements. And, you know, our ability to get Iran to do what we want in the future may be compromised by this move, rather than improve. That is to say, we may actually have less control over the situation than and maneuver ourselves into a position where if the agreement fully dissolves, Iran goes full tilt into enrichment, then we'll head down a path where we'll hit a fork in the road. Either Iran becomes a nuclear weapons state, or we have to go to war to prevent it. That's a box we really don't want to be in. So I think that if the agreement needed fixing, then we should have tried to negotiate to improve it instead of just walking away from it, especially walking away from it unilaterally. That doesn't make any sense diplomatically. And not having inspectors in there gives us less information and less intelligence about what Iran is really doing, as opposed to more. So it's a head scratcher for me, I think, in terms of why now, why this.
And the president and his newer national security advisor, John Bolton, had said the agreement really didn't do anything. It didn't do enough effectively to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. It had a sunset provision where when it ended, they wanted it to go on longer, in effect, to keep Iran from processing nuclear fuel. They were worried about Iran as a bad actor in the Mideast and beyond when it came to support for terrorism. Are these things that should have been concerns that should have been integrated into this deal?
The concerns about Iran as a bad actor are well-motivated. They have been a state sponsor of terror. They are an existential threat to Israel. They are potential axis of conflict in the broader Middle East, the conflict between Sunnis and Shiites. And, you know, but having said that, the question becomes then, how do you go about maximizing your influence in a way that gives you control of the situation as opposed to the Iranians? And, you know, you don't want to encourage more nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. I mean, we already have a situation in North Asia with North Korea. Looks like we're making some political progress there. Ironically, who thought at this time in 2018, I mean, a year ago, who would have imagined that we would be in good shape with negotiations on North Korean nuclear program and walking out on an agreement we had signed with the Iranians, and indeed the international community had signed with the Iranians. And, you know, there are reasons to hope that the regime in Iran would behave in a better way with respect to support for terrorism, with respect to, frankly, the way it treats many of its own people, with respect to the activities of its more hawkish factions in the regime. But the way you improve Iran's domestic and foreign policy behavior is by increasing your leverage over them. And I think that walking out of this agreement gives us less leverage. And then slapping sanctions on, this will only make constructive negotiations more difficult. It will alienate the regime further. It will empower the hawks in Tehran. And we will be standing alone, except perhaps with Israel, on the political issue about how to deal with the risk of non-proliferation in Iran and in this region.
Talking to Stephen Simbala from Penn State Brandywine, distinguished professor of political science there. He's written multiple books on nuclear weapons and diplomacy. And Steve, you've thought and written a lot since the end of the Cold War about nuclear proliferation and how we stop it. In some ways, back in the day, we thought Cold War is over. We don't have this threat of nuclear war. In some ways, though, things have gotten more complicated. How have you seen the international community addressing these issues in the last, 25 years or so?
Well, the good news is that many of our worst fears weren't confirmed. The nuclear weapons, I think it was John Kennedy, when he was president, worried that as many as 20 or 30 countries might have nuclear weapons, you know, even in the Cold War years. That hasn't happened. We've probably had less nuclear proliferation than we deserve, and we can be thankful for that, but I think shows that the non-proliferation treaty and other things that we and other countries have done has been helpful in restraining the number of states that have become nuclear weapon states. The problem, however, is that in the 21st century, we have a variety of forces that are pushing the problem. The problem in the Cold War was, you know, pretty much the United States and the Soviet Union, and they're building up large arsenals, sort of vertical proliferation, and trying to keep that from getting out of control. And now it's more a question of horizontal proliferation, with nuclear weapons spreading to more countries. And we already have in Asia a dangerous situation with China, India, Pakistan, Russia, North Korea, all nuclear powers. And we don't want to see something like that happen in the Middle East. That would be bad news for containing the spread of nuclear weapons and technology related to nuclear weapons. So we've moved from a Cold War situation where you had a dangerous situation, but one that was simple to understand, a U.S.-Soviet global rivalry supported by their nuclear weapons and nuclear power. And now we have a less clearly structured situation that's, for the reasons we're seeing right now, more challenging to manage.
I want to talk about the motivations for some countries like Iran, maybe North Korea, too, in wanting nuclear weapons. It seems like one thought process might be, hey, we don't want to end up being the next Saddam Hussein, overthrown by outside powers, Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, overthrown with the help of outside powers. If we have a nuclear weapon, that's a deterrent. And in Iran may be thinking, well, Israel has this officially unacknowledged but widely believed nuclear presence itself. Why don't we have something to balance that? Can you talk about those motivations for why the countries we're worried about want these nuclear weapons?
Yeah, that's an especially interesting question. And there's no... If you're North Korea and you're looking at what happened to Saddam Hussein and you're looking at what happened to Muammar Gaddafi and you're thinking, well, you know, then the only way we can prevent somebody, the United States, trying regime change against North Korea is to make sure that we have at least a small number of nuclear weapons. That's a reasonable, unfortunate inference on their part, which is why, by the way, I think we had better be realistic about our objectives in negotiating with North Korea. I see talking heads on TV already demanding that the United States should insist on, you know, comprehensive, verifiable, irreversible dismantlement, the whole takedown of North Korea's entire nuclear weapons capability. But I'm doubtful that North Korea is going to put that on the table right up front. After all, for the reason you just mentioned, their nuclear weapons are, in their view, an insurance policy against the takedown of their regime. So that's going to take, we may have to go for something more limited in terms of dealing with North Korea. And as for the Middle East, there's absolutely a large risk here that if Iran becomes a declared nuclear weapons state or a de facto nuclear weapons state, then others will almost certainly follow. What happens then? What does Turkey do? What does Egypt do? What does Saudi Arabia do? And then one can hardly imagine a more combustible situation than a Middle East multipolar nuclear system.
We're talking to Stephen Simbala right now, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Penn State Brandywine, with us to talk about the Iran nuclear deal and nuclear proliferation since the Cold War, really. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's announcement today, violating the agreement with Iran and other countries, reimposing sanctions on Iran in spite of the Iran nuclear deal? What do you think the world community should be doing to prevent nuclear weapons proliferation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the spread of nuclear weapons in light of President Trump's announcement that the U.S. would pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. Stephen Simbala is with us, distinguished professor of political science at Penn State. Brandywine, you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the U.S. pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal? What does it mean for the North Korea negotiations along the way? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Hi. I guess you just mentioned my biggest concern, which is we finally are apparently getting a breakthrough with North Korea, and just what kind of signal does this send? I mean, how can North Korea ever expect that we're going to stand by any deal that we make with them to control their nuclear weapons, or how can any other country at this point take us seriously when we break our word like this?
Steve, thanks for the call. Steve Simbala, if the U.S. leaves the Iran deal, can North Korea, can other countries count on us on future deals?
That's a very good point. John Bolton, I see, is quoted here saying that another aspect of the withdrawal decision was to establish a position of strength for the United States, and it will have implications for the dealing with North Korea. Sends a very clear signal that the U.S. will not accept inadequate deal. Well, that's his version of it, but I think your caller has just made the opposite point, which is it may raise questions about our credibility in following through on commitments we've made.
Thanks a lot for that call. Iran, it sounds like, is looking to negotiate with the other signatories to this agreement, U.S. allies like France, Germany, and the U.K., also Russia. I think China, too, was part of this deal. Will the deal remain significant even if the U.S. isn't playing along anymore?
Well, that's very complicated. The Iranians are, as you say, they've made a public statement that they want to continue to work with the other signatories and keep the deal in place. On the other hand, they're also making threats to resume enrichment, full tilt. So it's not quite clear where they're going to go with this. The Europeans definitely want to continue with the JCPOA, and it's not clear if and how this will affect what we're doing and saying with North Korea. So there's a great deal of, for sure, a great deal of uncertainty has been introduced into the non-proliferation equation by this decision.
We heard from John in Madison, who wants to know, how effective can U.S. sanctions be if Iran is trading with other U.S. allies? And that's part of the deal with these sanctions, is it punishes countries that at least in some ways, trade with Iran. The president specifically said that help with Iran's nuclear ambitions, but it isn't clear that the sanctions would stop there. So what does the sanction regime now mean for not just Iran, but for its trading partners, including U.S. allies?
The sanctions regime will be weaker if, you know, the allies are not cooperating, if the United States is going it alone on sanctions. The sanctions worked to get to the JCPOA precisely because we had unanimity, especially among the major economic and military powers. And now that we're going in one direction and the rest of the signatories to the JCPOA seem to be going in another direction, there's only so much the United States can do unilaterally. There will doubtless be leakage if we're going it alone with sanctions.
Let's bring on another caller now. We have Steve with us in Sussex. Steve, hi.
Yes, I just wanted to say that, you know, over the last couple of days, I've heard that Iran has been developing their nuclear weapon program and all this. So it's like they're not holding up their part of the bargain either. So why should we?
Steve, thanks for that call. Steve Simbala, the president had referred to Iran lying to us, but he may have been referring to the Israeli presentation saying that Iran had misled the international community before the agreement. Do we have evidence that Iran is not following the terms of the agreement since it was signed?
Well, you know, the Israeli presentation, I think, is very controversial. The U.S. Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, in their most recent statements on this subject, said that, as far as they know, Iran is in full compliance with the requirements of the agreement.
Thanks a lot for that call, Steve. We heard from Reza, who wanted to know why no one ever brings up how many nuclear weapons Israel has in this conversation. Why do they get a pass? As I understand it, Steve, Israel doesn't say they do have nuclear weapons. They're not really saying they don't. What do we know about that, and how does that affect other countries in the Middle East and their ambitions to develop nuclear weapons?
Well, and in addition to that, Israel and Iran are of course, in a number of political confrontations that could spill over into a military confrontation. So, yes, that's Israel became a nuclear power very early in the Cold War years, and is sort of been grandfathered in, as it were, as a de facto nuclear weapon state, even though, as you say, their declaratory policy is that they neither confirm nor deny that they have nuclear weapons.
So do they? Are they getting a pass, in effect, as Reza is saying?
Yeah, in a sense, although, you know, we've all lived with this now for decades, and, you know, they also, I think, get a pass because they're a close ally of the United States, and, you know, we tend to count on them to carry a lot of our political water in the Middle East. They're very reliable allies. They're a democracy. And, you know, there's a lot of domestic political support for the state of Israel in the United States. And, you know, the American administrations, Republican and Democratic, have both been supported Israel on defense issues.
Let's take one more caller. Todd is with us in Green Bay. Todd, hi.
Good morning, or good afternoon, sorry.
Sure.
Well, one thing about your last point is I don't think Israel, one of the reasons why Israel, I feel better about them at least having weapons, is that they've never threatened to blow anybody off the face of the earth when other nations have threatened to do that to Israel. But my point for calling was, I just wanted to ask you, guess what was actually in this deal for us? My understanding is that we were given promises that they would discontinue their nuclear ambitions, but we also were not allowed to go and check for ourselves. I guess we were relying on our proxies to do that for
Todd,
us.
Todd, thanks for the call. Just very briefly, Steve, we're just about out of time. What kind of access did we or the international community get to Iranian possible nuclear programs?
The JCPOA provides for inspections by international inspectors, the IAEA. And those inspections are, inspections may or may not be foolproof, but the point is you have inspectors in there, they're looking around, and they not only get you technical information, they also get you valuable intelligence about what's going on in the country as a whole. So you're getting all kinds of useful information.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Stephen Simbala, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Penn State Brandywine, talking about the Iran nuclear deal and nuclear proliferation issues around the world.